So, hello and welcome to the latest episode of the In The Zone podcast with me, Mike Ryder.
And me, Josh Hughes.
In today's episode, we're going to talk about Olympic sport and specifically the case of Castra Semenya.
Yeah, so recently, or currently, Castra Semenya is taking a case to the Court of Arbitration for Sport. And the Court of Arbitration for Sport is pretty much what it sounds like. It deals with sporting rules and athletes and organisations who think they've been unfairly treated.
Yeah, and all of this goes back to a move by the IAAF, International Association of Athletics Federations.
Ah, okay.
The IAAF, so it's sort of the governing body for
track and field.
For track and field. And so the idea is that they claim that Castra Semenya has too much testosterone in her blood, essentially.
Yeah,
so she suffers from hypoandrogenism.
So Castra Semenya is a fantastic 800-metre runner from South Africa.
Yeah.
And because of this apparent condition that the IAAF say she has, they want to treat her very, very much differently from any other woman.
Yes, and this sort of cuts to the heart of the debate when you say any other woman. Because the idea here is that she has too much testosterone in her blood, which makes her essentially better at running the 800 metres than other women athletes. So back in April 2018, the IAAF said that they were going to introduce this rule to essentially treat Castra Semenya to reduce her testosterone levels. And they've said that the idea is to, and I quote, preserve fair and meaningful competition in the female classification, end quote. They also then went on to say, quote, to create a level playing field and ensure that success is determined by talent, dedication, hard work, and the other values and characteristics that the sport embodies and celebrates, end quote.
Well, I think sort of our discussion that we've had off air, kind of we're questioning what they mean by talent, because to a lot of people and to me, talent is something that you're genetically disposed towards. You're born with the talent. Usain Bolt was born to run fast, or born with the ability to run fast. And it seems like Castra Semenya, well, was born with the ability to run fast. Whether that's a secondary impact of being born with a predisposition towards a greater level of testosterone than other women seem to be.
Yeah, and this is where it gets really tricky, because essentially what they're saying is, we've created two arbitrary definitions of what we mean by man and what we mean by woman. And because Castra Semenya is essentially a limit case, she operates within the field of woman, female. She's female. She's a female athlete. However, she has more testosterone, which gives her a competitive advantage, which you could describe as a talent. But what the Olympic Committee and what the IAAF are saying is essentially her talent goes too far.
Mm.
So she's got too much. She's just her genetics are such that she's too good to be in the female classification.
Which is very strange, because the entirety of the Olympics is about winning medals. Well, not the entirety, but the major part of the Olympic movement and athletic movement is about winning medals and being the best. And
being the best that you can be.
And so Castra Semenya trying to be the best that she can be with a natural genetic predisposition is apparently too good.
Yeah. And it's funny, because you don't say, well, we're going to make Usain Bolt a little bit shorter. So, because his natural sort of body shape, body type, while is unusual for a 100-metre sprinter.
Yeah, he's a bit taller than most. He's 6'5", whereas most sprinters are a bit shorter, aren't they?
Yeah, so essentially, because of his sort of slightly longer legs, essentially he's able to run that much faster with the same sort of twitch muscle fibres as...
As a shorter man.
As a shorter man. So, but we don't say, oh, we're gonna do something to stop you. We're gonna lop a couple of inches off the bottom of your legs, do we? Because that would be ridiculous.
Yeah.
So why are we suddenly saying this about Castra Semenya?
Mm. So I mean, I guess the most obvious question to ask is, do you think there's a gender issue? Are we treating Castra differently because she's a woman?
Well, that is a good question. I think one part of it is the testosterone part, in that testosterone is a sort of a male hormone.
Yeah, so it's naturally present in women, but it's more prevalent in men, and therefore perceived to be a male thing.
And it's the testosterone that ultimately sort of gives men their sort of strength speed over the sort of competitive advantage over a woman, which is why we differentiate between men's and women's events. But where Semenya is she's at this sort of border between the two. And what this goes to show is the sort of essentially the arbitrary definition of what you mean by a man and a woman. So if you're saying, well, it's down to your, are you saying it's down to the amount of testosterone in your blood? Are you saying it's down to your genitals? Are you saying it's down to how you identify yourself? And this, I mean, this goes far beyond the Olympic movement and the IAAF. I mean, this is a pressing issue in real life.
Transgender athletes in sport, it seems to be the main issue that's happening in sport at the moment, I think.
Yeah, I think feminism has a massive problem with transgender athletes.
Well, a lot of people talk about trans-exclusionary radical feminists, don't they? As though trans women aren't women because they weren't born women.
Yeah, right? And I mean, you could say, well, is there an element of jealousy going on there? Because essentially, those trans women who were once men will probably have the muscle disposition to have a competitive advantage, perhaps.
Yeah, I mean, well, the International Olympic Committee has basically taken the stance that if somebody who was born a man wants to compete as a female, then they have to basically spend a certain amount of time having undergone hormonal therapies to make them hormonally, and I guess in terms of and physiologically is the aim to be more feminine, or what we think of as feminine. But something Joe Rogan on his podcast has talked about this quite a bit, and on this issue I think he's probably right. Someone who's say been a man for 25, 30 years, you know, competed in sport and whatever, and has a substantial amount of muscle mass and bone density and height, much more in comparison to an average woman, realizes that they're inside, they feel like a woman and want to be perceived as such by the outside world, and so transition, for them to then compete against biological women, having had 25 or 30 years of great levels of testosterone and therefore great levels of muscle mass, bone density, height and whatever, it's not as easy to see that as a fair sporting playing field.
No, I think in that situation, because there's outside intervention, I think because a process is undergone to sort of transfer from being what we define inverted commas as a man to being what we define inverted commas as being a woman.
Yeah.
I mean, I can see there being some sort of difference there. I think the problem then comes when you talk about Castra Semenya and you're saying, well, ultimately, she was born genetically with this sort of condition that makes her better at running the 800 metres than 99% of women out there.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the transgender issue is an important issue in sport, but it's a separate issue from Castra Semenya.
Yeah, it is, yeah.
She obviously isn't transgender. She is a woman and was born a woman. Is treated as a woman in most countries, but seemingly in a sport, she's treated as something different.
Yeah, and I just find it incredibly disturbing. It's quite dystopian, this idea that, well, okay, so she's so good that we're going to actually enforce that she takes some drugs and sort of be treated to make her more of what we define as a woman.
Or what the IAAF.
Or what the IAAF define as a woman. So on the one hand, you've got this idea that, well, the IAAF is defining what we mean by man and woman.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, let's not forget what happens if you're a man and you haven't got enough testosterone. I mean, you probably wouldn't be competing at the Olympics, let's be fair. I mean, the same could be said of female athletes who haven't got maybe enough testosterone to be able to compete.
Well, actually, you've just reminded me of something, but apparently it's not unusual for professional athletes to have slightly lower than expected testosterone levels. Because they use it so much in training.
Mm.
So to then turn around and say to Castra Semenya, oh, well, you might do all this training, but you've still got too much. Kind of adds to the dichotomy in which she's seen. Mm. That actually, if a lot of athletes actually have slightly lower than is expected, and she's got higher than is expected, then it adds to kind of the perception that she's, well, the perception and, I guess, in some ways, biological reality that she is different from average.
Well, she's an outlier. But then aren't all Olympic athletes different from average?
I suppose they're different from the average person, aren't they? But they're outliers who are grouped together.
But and this is the paradox of the whole situation.
Yeah.
So you've got a group of outliers, but you're saying one outlier isn't outlier enough, or they don't fit within that what is actually a box. Essentially, yeah. You've got these two boxes, male and female athletes. So then what do you do? Do you create a separate third box for people?
Superstars?
Well, I mean, but this is it though, isn't it? Because as soon as you start doing that, then you're saying, well, what do you do? Do you put them in the Paralympics? I mean, because you couldn't do that. So, or do you break down the male and female classifications?
Yeah, it's incredibly difficult. I mean, yesterday on the news, me saying yesterday will highlight when this is put out, the delay in broadcast. But yesterday on the news, I saw that there was a female cyclist in Belgium who caught up to the back of the men's race.
Mm.
And so at that point, race organisers decided to what they call neutralise the race, so basically slow it down. The women's race, the men's race was allowed to carry on, and then once they were sufficiently slowed down enough to have a gap, the person who had caught up to the men's race was then allowed to basically make and then maintain a small head start that she'd you know spent the race achieving basically.
So again, you're putting limits on what we define as women and what women can achieve in sport.
Yeah, and I mean, I guess then it links back to the transgender debate around. Should trans athletes compete with biological? Should transgender? Should they compete with people who are biologically the same gender as they are?
Yeah.
And I guess it's for some people it's an easy decision, isn't it? If someone presents as a woman, they are a woman, they should be treated as a woman, they should compete against women. If they present as a woman, as a man, then it should be the same. But you see a lot of people who are uneasy about that, you know, for the issue that I highlighted earlier. And I suppose it's probably most obvious when it comes to combat sports.
Mm.
To have somebody who is, you know, born a woman, lived as a woman for however many years, and then transitions into being a man, you would have to be a very brave fight promoter to allow a fight between a transgender man and a biological man to happen, because, well, the expectation would be that the transgender man would get absolutely mauled. Whether that's true or not, I guess we'll never know. But yeah. I mean, but also, I suppose you can think back to the Battle of the Sexes tennis match between Billie Jean King and the bloke whose name I've forgotten, which I suppose highlights the importance of the match in Billie Jean King. In that, actually, in some sports, the differences in gender, differences in biological gender, aren't quite as pronounced as they are in other sports, and therefore, the impact that somebody being transgender would have would probably be lower. And we've already mentioned cycling. I remember reading Chrissy Wellington's autobiography. She was a triathlete that competed at Ironman distance. Ironman being a questionable term when you're talking about Chrissy Wellington, who was obviously a woman. And she was so fast at iron distance triathlon, let's call it. Well, most people call it iron distance now. Actually, she nearly started beating course records that were set by men. So, you know, the difference there was quite minimal, and there's some evidence to show that ultra-endurance distance, whether it's running or cycling or swimming, then sometimes women tend to be better. Actually, there was an ultra-distance fell marathon, or some people call them sky runs, in Britain not so long ago, where a woman beat the course record by a substantial distance. And she was also breastfeeding at the time, over a week, and a PhD student. So she put, not only did she put some of the men in the race to shame, she also put every other PhD student to shame.
Yeah, I just wonder, is there something biologically about having just given birth? Maybe that might actually have given her an advantage there.
I don't know, maybe. I mean, I think there's a couple of sort of anecdotes about around that, and sort of maybe the body produces kind of lots of
cortisone? I mean, I don't know. Obviously, we're not medical professionals, but
yeah, don't take any medical advice. But maybe the body does produce something that you know, allows recent mothers to kind of to endure stuff a bit more. I mean, obviously that would be useful. If we think back to kind of the caveman context, that would be probably pretty useful to be able to you know, if you're on a migration or something, and you know you need to be able to give birth and carry the baby and feed the baby for however long.
Well, I mean,
get to your destination, and maybe food isn't available at the time or whatever. That so I could absolutely believe that maybe the body does produce something, but. I don't know. Is the short answer, but I suppose kind of the opposite of that. We've already mentioned kind of the combat sports aspect, but recently there was a case of a transgender female, Laurel Hubbard, who was born a man and then transitioned to being a woman and then competed as a woman in weightlifting. I think actually. Whilst in the period of their life when she was a male, she actually competed as a weightlifter, and then, you know, continues to compete as a female. And I don't think anyone would have a problem with somebody continuing their hobbies.
Well, if it's a hobby, it's weird. I wonder if how much they could lift changed.
Yeah. So Laurel Hubbard competed at the Commonwealth Games in the 90s. Kilo and over class. What's the women's super heavyweight category? And was on to win, I think, until she injured herself, unfortunately. But again, like with the combat sports example, it kind of just highlights that so having many years of greater muscle mass and bone density and height and whatever. And I guess if you want to be brutal about it, it's genetic athletic advantage over women in that context, in the context of weightlifting. We all of the world records to do with weightlifting, you know, men tend to outshine women. And so I guess I don't know if disparity is the right word, but to some people would be an inappropriateness.
Mm.
In almost all cases, no one cares about someone becoming transgender. And no one's going to say, oh, you can't do this hobby because you've transitioned. But when it comes to competition, there's, I think,
it's
fair to at least discuss it, I think.
Yeah. I mean, again, going back to the Cassius Semenya case, I mean, it's clearly, it's not a case of being trans, though, is it? It's just a case of her naturally having more testosterone than others. And, I mean, it just opens up a whole sort of...
It's a can of worms.
Can of worms, yeah. So, I mean, talking about the martial arts, I mean, this is something I've been thinking about for a while. Is the solution, do we think? I mean, have we got this whole athletics classification thing wrong from the start? Do we, I'm just throwing this out there, do we do, like they do in martial arts or whatever, do we have, not like a weight category, but what we could do, you do have categories, do you subdivide it down? So you say, well, testosterone rating between X and Y and weight category between X and Y as well. So open up sports to a far greater range of people and audiences, and where competition then becomes a little bit more down to talent and hard work and not just down to who has genetic advantage.
Well, maybe. I mean, obviously you see in combat sports and strength sports, you see weight classes in addition to gender classes.
Yeah.
But I suppose the question about whether it's... whether people would want to watch it.
Yeah.
That's what he's wanted. I mean, that's... Does anybody want to watch a super heavyweight 1500 metre race when it's going to be, in all likelihood, a lot slower than the lightweight race?
Yeah, I mean, we're talking here about then sort of bringing like the whole capitalist imperative. You're thinking, well, what do people want to pay money to watch?
Yeah.
But I'm just thinking, I mean, because it just troubles me that Olympic sport is built up to be this sort of great sort of pinnacle of human endeavour and achievement. But then... It's so arbitrary, this sort of this construct of what we mean by man, what we mean by woman, and what we mean by performance and sport and achievement. Ultimately, we create this idea of what we mean to be this sort of perfect, what we mean by performance, what we mean by success. Success, which typically is defined in masculine terms, because most of the Olympic sports are typically physical. They're not so much mental challenges.
Yeah, I mean, gone are the days where essay writing and poetry was Olympic competition.
Yeah, and there was something on the radio the other day. I know that they've been trying to get snooker into, and sort of billiard sports into the Olympics, and which you would describe, I suppose, as skill sports, if you describe them as sports at all. But you describe them as skill-based competitions, and they are really hard.
Mm.
But for some reason, they're not seen as being as worthy of Olympic inclusion as, say, breakdancing.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting what's in the Olympics and what isn't. Because weightlifting, or Olympic weightlifting, has been on the Olympic calendar for a long time. But a very similar sport, powerlifting, isn't. And apparently, the inside track is that powerlifting will never be an Olympic sport because it's three lifts rather than two, and there's not enough time to broadcast it.
So again, it's the capitalist imperative of what works. And you've got this whole sort of tradition as well, sort of limiting, like, people want to see the 100 metres, so regardless of how it's only 10 seconds, people, that's the most watched Olympic event. And then you've got these events that people sort of like, they do sort of like marathons and all this stuff, it's sort of 5-6 hours.
But, 5-6 hours? That's it.
No, but...
going on for two.
I'm thinking about, like, what do you think about the walking as well, don't you?
Power walking.
Yeah, but what I'm saying is people invest hours and hours and hours of time into what their one single event, whereas you just invest 10 seconds in an event, and it's worth the same. And then, well, you've got the sort of pentathletes as well, the heptathletes, and so on. And you're saying, well, all these things are worth the equivalent in terms of success. And what does it say about what we mean by success?
Yeah, and I suppose there's another quote just to highlight what you just said, heptathletes and pentathletes. Heptathlon is a female event and pentathlon is a male event. Yeah. Obviously, a female athlete could do 10 events, men could do 7. But there's an arbitrary delineation there between the amount of events that women are allowed to do.
And what events we describe as being worthy of consideration.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, why don't you make women do the same amount of events and vice versa, or vice versa?
Yeah.
I mean, it's like with sets in tennis.
Yeah. I was just going to say that. I mean, women play 3 sets and men play 5, despite the fact that the women have already said that they're more than happy to pay 5.
And there's a prize money issue as well. But you're right. It's something that goes a lot wider, I think, than sort of competition and all this stuff. Because essentially, all these things describe what we mean by human, what we mean by performance, what we mean by success.
Yeah.
And what's so disheartening about this whole Caster Semenya thing is essentially that they've sort of raised her up as this sort of pinnacle for exclusion, this sort of exclusory figure who, because for no fault of her own, is better at 800 metres than a lot of other people, that we're saying, well, actually, no, we've got to do something to you to stop you being so good.
Yeah, I mean, if she was...
Or stop you being how you were born to be.
Exactly. I mean, if she was, you know, slightly better than everybody else, then nobody would bat an eyelid, even if she did still have a raised testosterone level in comparison to other biological women. But the fact that she's so good...
Yeah, or she's running towards the back of the field. Or, I mean, if she wasn't at the front, especially, no one would bat an eyelid at all.
Yeah, so it's not just about a gender or... It's primarily about performance, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so, and it's worrying for, like, the authorities. Because she undermines, I think, what we sort of describe to be... Sort of, what fits within our realms of normalcy and normal behaviour.
Yeah. And kind of the fact that the IAAF is willing to, or is making moves to attempt to give a particular, or force drugs upon her in order to allow us to compete, just highlights kind of the dystopian nature of how this case is going. And we've mentioned before about whether, would countries or would organisations, go beyond this and potentially move on to kind of genetically modifying athletes to make them better.
Yeah, I mean, it follows that's the next logical step. Essentially, if we're going to say, okay, well, we're going to train our athletes to be the best they can possibly be, right, you get to a certain stage where you can only feed them and train them so much.
Yeah.
The next stage is ultimately like, well, we're going to sort of maybe sort of genetically screen them. I mean, that sounds almost like sort of eugenics type thing, but... Yeah. But which is quite dystopian, obviously.
Absolutely. I mean, there are some sort of examples, I guess, of not quite going this far, but pretty much. sort of in certainly in the Bulgarian weightlifting team in the 80s, it was basically everybody who showed an aptitude for weightlifting was put into the team, at least onto the training program, and those who survived were put on the Olympic team and usually won.
Mm.
So you can see screening for predispositions being done, but to go beyond that and to go into forcing athletes to take drugs and to maybe more in the future is just worrying.
Well, yeah, I mean, screening them, or do we say, well, we'll start training them earlier and earlier? So we'll find the kids at the age 10, then we'll put them in a school and we'll pay for them to sort of,
yeah,
be trained from an early age. Because then what happens is Olympics then becomes actually a political thing. I mean, it's always been a political thing. Let's be clear. It's all about politics and sort of posturing on an international level. But yeah, it just, I mean, it's so sort of just worrying, really, isn't it? Dystopian futures.
Yeah, I mean, you've got to worry about what happens after they're too old.
Yeah.
I mean, somebody who's been, if somebody is raised to be a medal winner, you know, they get to however whatever age and they can't do it anymore, then what's their life about? I mean, it's not unusual to see, you know, professional footballers who lose, can't play anymore because they're too old or they're injured or whatever, and they don't actually, you know, they don't have anything to do, they don't have any skills because they've spent their entire life geared towards being a footballer.
Kicking a ball around, doesn't give you many practical life skills, let's be fair.
I mean, you see it at every level in football particularly. You see people who, you know, teenagers who don't get academy places go into menial jobs with no skills. You see academy players who don't get professional contracts doing exactly the same, and then at the end of the professional career, you see the same again sometimes.
Yeah, I mean, because we put Olympians on such a pedestal, we put sports people on such a pedestal, we don't think about the people who don't make it,
yeah,
which is highly problematic. But then on the other foot, you could also say, well, we don't think about what happens to people once they have made it. I mean, I'm thinking specifically of contact sports, head contact sports, football. I know it's not mentioned very much in the news, but there's this case of a lot of the old players who used to head very heavy balls.
Yeah.
Sort of Alzheimer's.
Serious head injuries. I mean, Muhammad Ali is obviously the predominant example.
Yeah.
I'm
thinking sort of also rugby as well.
Rugby, American football, you know, concussions and concussion-related injuries are prevalent all the time.
Yeah. So on the one hand, we're saying, okay, well, we want you to sort of bash your head loads because that's what our sport requires.
We want to watch, yeah.
But then you're saying, well, actually, at the same time, you could get some serious head injuries that could basically damage you for the rest of your life.
Yeah. I mean, it's winning a game or a medal in the Olympics or whatever else is, you know, is it worth it? Yeah, in comparison to.
And you've got to say, well, going back to Kasia Semenya to sort of round ourselves off here, I mean, will she think ultimately, is it worth it, me doing this? I mean, if the IAAF are going to win their case and say, well, you've got to take these drugs, why should she do that?
Exactly.
Because it's a complete sort of. It was a farce, ultimately. I mean, yeah. Sort of put my stall out there. So yeah, it's ridiculous that you should be doing that to someone.
Yeah, I mean, if I was Castamania, I don't think I would play their game.
Maybe. I mean, she's already had to put up with all this sort of media sort of stuff around her, lots of sort of pictures of her looking fairly masculine running around the track, and just to sort of play on these sort of fears of.
Yeah, I mean, I guess you've got to ask yourself: would you put up with this type of questioning just so you can do your day job?
No,
exactly. I don't think I would, I wouldn't. I wouldn't blame Caster Semenya if she decided I've had enough.
Mm.
I mean, I absolutely understand that she is an athlete. She wants to compete. So, yeah, take the case to the court of arbitration and win, and try and win. But, well, if I'm honest, actually, I'd probably if I was a fellow athlete, you know, normally competing against Caster Semenya, I'd probably actually come out in support of her and.
Well, it's hard, isn't it?
A runner's strike.
Because
it's just, you know, it's horrendous treatment of Caster Semenya, but it could equally have been anybody else.
Yeah, well, it could have. Yeah, I agree. But the sort of disturbing thing that comes to my mind is, like, okay, so they give her this treatment. They say, right, okay, we're going to take X amount of testosterone out of your blood. At what point do you stop? So do you say, okay, we're going to take 5 to 7 seconds off your time. So say you did that. Say you give it a shrimp. Then she's still winning by a couple of seconds.
Yeah.
So do we then say, okay, no, we're going to up your treatment now because you're still winning. So why should she continue? Why? Because essentially, what point do you say we've taken enough testosterone out of your blood? We've sort of limited you so much.
Exactly. Nobody would take that from anybody else. Nobody would take that from the state.
No.
Nobody would take that from their employer. And yet, the IAAF is expecting Caster Semenya to take it from an organisation that governs track and field events.
Yeah, I mean, what it says about the world that we live in, I think it's awful, really.
Absolutely, yeah.
It's quite and it's disturbing dystopian future. Or disturbing dystopian now, in fact.
Yeah, I mean, for me, I can only hope that Caster Semenya wins and nobody tries...
Continues to compete.
Yeah, continues to compete and no organisation tries this again.
Yeah, I agree. Oh, so on that note, I think that brings us to a nice end.
I think so.
Right, thank you very much. Thank you for listening to the In The Zone podcast with Mike Ryder and Josh Hughes.
For more podcasts and interesting chat, visit InTheZonePodcast.com.